Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
Hello, everyone. As many of you have read and heard, Ann Saxelby last Saturday passed away. She was the founding member of the Cutting the Curd program, ahead of the podcast game. She started Cutting the Curd over 10 years ago to introduce cheese to everyone and promote sustainable agriculture as much as possible. But she was more than just a host of Cutting the Curd. She was also an amazing woman, a pioneer to the cheese industry, writer, wife, and a mother to three children. She paved the way for women to start their own cheese businesses at Saxelby Cheesemongers. She will be greatly missed. At Cutting the Curd, we will have an upcoming tribute episode to commemorate Anne. Our condolences go to her family and everyone at Saxelby Cheesemongers. We stand with the entire cheese community in missing her. This includes all the local cheese farmers and creameries she worked with over the years, and all the cheesemongers she helped mentor. Anne, we will always miss your kindness and positivity. Thank you for being you. HRN is creating an audio tribute to Anne. If you'd like to send in a memory or message, please email or send a voice memo to tribute@heritageradionetwork.org or call 203-998-5636 to record a message. If you would like to donate to the Ann Saxelby Legacy Fund to provide training opportunities to financially distressed teenagers and young adults, please donate at slowfoodusa.org/Saxelby/. Dear listeners, we ask you now to take a moment of silence before we begin this next episode of Cutting the Curd, to remember Anne.
Hello, and welcome to Cutting the Curd. I'm your host today, Jessica Kesselman. I am so excited to be welcoming today's guest, Yoav Perry, founder of Perrystead Dairy in Philadelphia. Yoav has been in the cheese industry for quite a while, and now he has his own creamery creating new American original cheeses in a city known for great food and surrounded by counties known for great milk. We have so many things to talk about. I am so happy that you're here today, Yoav. Welcome to Cutting the Curd.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I know you're getting a lot of press lately, and thank you for coming on the show. Welcome back, I should say. You were a guest before on Cutting the Curd, but now you are a cheesemaker with your own creamery. Can you tell us a little bit about Perrystead Dairy as we get started?
Sure. Perrystead Dairy is a creamery. It's an urban creamery in Philadelphia. We are right in the middle of the city, in the Kensington neighborhood, next to Fishtown, if people know Philly. We make American original cheese, lots of short seasonal runs and interesting experimental things, with beautiful milk from farmers that are only about 40 minutes from us. So we're surrounded with all this beautiful, countryside and incredible dairy farmers. So we're taking the full advantage of that.
So can you tell us a little bit about why Philadelphia and more about how this location is pretty key? I mean, it serves a lot of great purposes from receiving the milk and getting your cheeses out to the customers.
Yeah, absolutely. Philadelphia is really on the kind of on both corridors, the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic, and we're right by the I-95, so stuff can make it to New York City and to DC in a matter of a couple of hours with our distributors. It's being in the city enables us to be close to farmers on one hand, but also to the consumers, the real the real taste makers, the chefs, the distributors. So it's kind of a perfect storm of elements here.
Yeah, and I know you've got some retail distribution locally, and you're getting quite a following. You had a recent interview with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Congratulations on that.
And
they were describing this new model. Often people use the words urban creamery when talking about Peristead Dairy. And I know when you and I talked about this, getting ready for this interview, and we talked about food systems and about like really supporting, family farms and high quality milk. And can you tell us a little bit about the milk that you're getting to make your cheese? How did you find these farmers, or who are they?
Well, we're surrounded with lots of counties that are producing, have wonderful producers of milk, and the conditions here are really good. There's a long green season, and there's a good diversity in cow breeds, and very responsive farmers. Lots of them do regenerative grazing and all kinds of more progressive practices. So that makes Philly even more of a real good key location for us. We lost about 1,600 dairy farmers in Pennsylvania since 2012, and that was even that. These are pre-pandemic numbers, and Pennsylvania used to be the fourth largest dairy producing state, and now it is I think number seven. But that happened in just a matter of maybe 3 or 4 years.
Wow!
So yeah, we've been seeing a lot of devastation. But the state actually has been really good about it, and they came up with a dairy investment program. And this enabled us to actually get into business because we got a grant, which really was the deciding factor to start doing this. And the proposal was to get this milk from producers that are really close to us, so we can create the value right here in the city where we're close to those creameries. And I mean, I'm sorry, close to those distributors and the restaurants and the customers and the corridor of the I-95. So that is really the concept behind the whole thing, to really build value for these farmers, to give them fantastic value for their fantastic milk.
Congratulations as well on receiving that grant. That was a pretty sizable grant.
Yeah, we weren't even in business yet, but it was, which is even more like I was kind of like, wow, we did it. But the proposal was really good. I'm like, let's get all this milk from all these farmers, put it here, instead of having them trying to make yogurt and cheese and figure out the expertise and figure out the packaging and figure out the delivery and who the customers are going to be and starting sales. If we just get their milk over here, we can do all that stuff, and we pay them a great added value for their milk. Obviously we can't afford to pay them the standard value of milk, which is laughable. Would have been laughable if it wasn't so sad, So mm-hmm. We paid them approximately twice as much, and it could be even more if the milk is of that quality that we want. Mm-hmm. So we want them to just focus on making incredible milk, and for us to be able to make the wonderful cheese with it without the other distractions. So we each would have our own distractions.
So you found the city, you found the location, you've got the great milk source. So let's talk about the cheeses and your vision for these cheeses being uniquely American. What do you mean when you talk about creating these American original cheeses? And then let's get into what these cheeses are.
Okay. My feeling is that we have all the elements here that we need. You know, if this was, 700 years ago and we had to make cheese, our trajectory would have been completely different. And being this immigration melting pot, I find that there's just so many opportunities to put that right there in the cheese instead of trying to recreate a brie here and just give it some local name of a creek or something, or create something that's original, but you're so embarrassed about it being original that you have to give it some French or Italian name, which we've seen.
Right, it goes both ways.
We've seen a lot of that out there, and I feel like screw it. It's time to stake our claims, and be proud of what we have, and we can create our own styles. We don't have to go with this, to cheddar our cheese, or to go with, Trappist style, washing, or with the same old bloomy rind. We can mix and match. We are in a time in history where we actually have access to lots of information, and to lots of bacterial cultures and specialty tools. And there's never been a time in history like this for cheesemakers, and we should celebrate it instead of trying to be like, well, that's not traditional and this is not how it used to be. What makes our time in history not equally important as other people's time in history? And cheese has always been an expression of culture and circumstances. And I feel that, if you think about it this way, there's nothing that stops us from creating our own styles, if it makes sense.
That totally makes sense in, cheese is storytelling. And to me, like, cheeses tell a story, and this is of a particular time and place. And so in many ways, what you're talking about is a unique American experience of this time and place, and all of those different elements that have been brought over here for generations, kind of influenced by where we are now.
Right. And I'm sorry, it may sound a little bit aloof the way I speak about it, but I'm just going to give you an example from a different industry in parallel, which would be coffee roasting, third wave coffee roasting. American coffee roasting was kind of laughable until, a couple of decades ago. And everybody were trying to mimic these Italian styles of these bitter coffees that are full of Robusta that were created in a really dark time in Italian history to give every worker a coffee for a lira. And then came the new, the third wave, coffee roasting movement, and everything changes. All of a sudden, people start realizing, wait a minute, there's all these different flavors and textures and seasonalities in coffee beans. Let's get it and roast it and make the best out of it. And all these incredible coffees start coming out of the United States and the UK and Australia, places that you'd never thought about for coffee roasting before. And it kind of left Italy in the dust a little bit, I mean, there's traditional Italian coffee, but there's not a lot of that modernization of that concept in Italy. And when you think about Europe in general, it's extremely protective of its regionality. And we are kind of a hodgepodge of all that here. And our cheese should reflect this story of us here.
So are you looking at that not just with the end product or the rind, but also with the rennet as well, right? I think you mentioned in a previous conversation we had, you have some interesting approaches and selections or decision-making, even from the choice of rennet.
Right. I think, well, Rennet, I think, is the unsung hero of cheese. I think people kind of like, they get whatever Rennet is available, and a lot of people don't think twice about it, but Rennet can really sing some songs. But yeah, you know, as a Jewish person, I feel that I have a story to tell with, which is, again, people telling their story through cheese, you know, of my history. Jews in the Iberian Peninsula used to use thistle rennet, which a lot of cheesemongers probably know all about, to coagulate their milk, because the milk clotting enzyme was not from an animal, so it was not it was de facto kosher. That technology have sort of disappeared from Jewish traditions with the Spanish Inquisition and deportation of the Jews in 1492, and they went on to nations where they did not have access to thistle, or the thistle was not growing in conditions to produce the milk clotting enzyme. So it kind of disappears from our tradition, but then it remained in Spain and Portugal in some capacity with the local producers. So here I am in America 500 years later, and I'm like, hey, we should get this going. So, you know, that was the birth of the Intergalactic, which is my favorite child right now. But that cheese is coagulated with thistle flowers. It's a lactic cheese, so it's really made more like a Loire Valley lactic goat cheese, but with cow's milk. And then it's aged a little bit like an Italian Robbiola, and it's in a tiny 3.5 ounce little cube that comes in a wooden box that you can actually bake it in the box if you want to. So, I mean, this is exactly what I'm talking about. That's that sort of combination of flavor, texture, aroma, and presentation that you just don't get in Europe right now. Or I should say seldom you get it, because Europeans just would not mix and match all of these very particular regional styles into one cheese.
I have to agree, it does play with the mind a little bit when you see the cheese, and we'll put some links up on our Instagram page and on the website. The Intergalactic, first of all, it's square and it's like a cube and it's small, and it has that brainy rind that I would associate with a goat cheese.
Right.
But it's cow's milk. And so there's a lot of things. And then you're talking about the thistle rennet, and it really does.
Which gives it this crazy notes of olive, which are really unique. And it does not taste at all like thistle rennet, like Azieto or Torta del Casar or any of those Iberian cheeses that you associate with thistle rennet usually.
Right. Can we talk about Atlantis for a little bit?
Sure. What do you want to know?
This cheese, also talk about like the brain trying to like process a new, you know, a new way to have a cheese. Can you tell us about this recipe? Like, what are you doing with this Atlantis? This is interesting to me.
Atlantis is wash rind. However, kind of playing with the curd and the bacterial culture mix is very unique, and it's probably like about 20 different cultures that go in there just to I mean, we can talk about this separately, but about my craziness with bacterial cultures, but it has this like interesting tang to it, but at the same time it could be kind of slightly supple, but the whole purpose is to wash it with seawater from the Atlantic. So we wash it with seawater that's been infused with up to 6 types of local North Atlantic types of seaweed and sea lettuces. So that's the headache that I have to deal with every day.
Right. Yes, but I'm sure it's going to be, you know, worth it in the end, because you're right, that is definitely an American original.
And it's a very difficult cheese to make, and I can tell you about it after our break.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. So we're going to take a short break to hear a word from our sponsor, and we'll be back in a minute with Yoav Perry.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Conte Cheese Association. Conte Cheese Association represents the Conte PDO, Conte Protected Designation of Origin, in the USA. Conte is a raw milk, cooked, pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Conte within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Conte. Conte takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineurs on average, each wheel of Conte is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Conte is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Conte is unique. Learn more about Conte, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at conte-usa.com. That's conte-usa.com.
And welcome back to Cutting the Curd. My guest today is Yoav Perry from Perrystead Dairy. And we were going to take a bit of a deep dive into the creation of Atlantis. You were mentioning this cheese is made with a blend of seaweed that grows in the Atlantic Ocean. Is that?
Yes, it is. And I over underestimated what headache that was going to be. seaweed has lots of iodine in it, and that plays against your bacterial cultures in a very significant way. So it took a long time to figure out how to tame this monster, but I think we got it right now. And it's surprisingly grassy, but the idea is not to create something that tastes like too much like a sea or like a fish. You know, you just want it to be lightly beachy.
Right.
And seaweed is very rich with glutamine, so it imparts all these super umami flavors into the cheese. And as the cheese matures, it gets more and more of the seaweed. So we actually started without the seaweed, just the infused water. And then it gets speckles of the seaweed only on the rind, but that's enough to give the cheese exactly what you want it to be. It's just like nicely balanced. It's reminiscent of the ocean, but it should not be more than that.
So interestingly, you describe these two cheeses that are very unique, very original, and yet one of the cheeses that really got your name out there was cream cheese. Which really is like, I mean, you're in Philadelphia and the East, you know, here we are in, you know, the East Coast, the Northeast, where we are all about our bagels and schmears. Mm-hmm. So you have the real Philly.
Right. So the real Philly is called the real Philly because Philadelphia cheese was never, ever made in Philadelphia. And Philadelphians are kind of gung-ho about what's theirs. So they appreciate it, as I think other people are. It's actually not a cream cheese. It's made with whole milk, so it's 2/3 less butterfat and way more flavor than cream cheese. It doesn't have any of this waxiness. It's just cultured milk. We use French Kafra in it and salt. That's it.
And where is this available? Have you been selling? Because you have a Do you have a market? I think you were telling me you have like a market in the front of your, or are there plans for having like a farmer's market?
No, we have a market.
Oh,
that,
great.
Goes on twice a month. So when we built our place, it kind of looked like a Kosovo after a day of bombing. It was like a junkyard, basically. And we have done a beautiful Mediterranean garden. We have like, you know, sumacs and feather grasses and the thistles grow here. And we have bronze fennel and ornamental onions and what have you. So we have this gorgeous garden right in front of the creamery. And we host, we're kind of in an area that has tons of amazing food producers, artisan food producers, anything from, you know, just like from pasta to Brazilian baked goods, to cideries. And, you know, we have distillery and we have two distilleries around the corners from us and two more breweries here. So there's so much going on. La Colombe is headquartered in, you know, mm-hmm. in this neighborhood too. So it's this kind of neighborhood, and the community has been absolutely incredibly accepting and loving of what we're doing. And because they cannot go into our facility that's inspected to oblivion, we decided to turn this front yard into a market and then invite all these other producers to sell here. And we don't even charge them anything. It's just for fun with the community.
Right. And you know, I mentioned you recently had this article in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and you have been getting a lot of press. And I love the fact that all of this press is, you know, it's all an opportunity for you to talk about cheese making and making, you know, kind of making people more aware of the resources even around them. When you're in a city, it's can sometimes be easy to forget where food comes from,
right?
Or, you know, and how it's made, and you're raising awareness and creating a wider audience for cheese. What has been the response? What are some of the responses you've been getting from people?
I see it. We just can't make enough cheese, so that's good. So, I mean, the response has been amazing, and we have people around the country also asking for our stuff. You know, we had a good exposure with Food and Wine magazine earlier in the season, so a lot of people got in touch with us. World's Best Cheese is now distributing our cheese around the country, so that's been a game changer for us. I love working with World's Best. So lots of lots of that. But people want to come in. They want to visit the place. They want to, you know, we made the garden market for the first time, and I had no idea if anyone was going to show up. And you know, it was going to start at 1 p.m. and at 12:50, I thought I was just going to have to apologize to all the poor vendors. And by 12:55, we had line around the block, and we had like 200 wow. people an hour coming, and everybody got cleaned out of their stuff by 3. So people are super excited. And it's like, it's also like a gentrifying old industrial neighborhood that everything is turning into lofts right now. So that's kind of, it just kind of jives with it. And we're next door to another well-gentrified neighborhood of Fishtown that has some incredible restaurants in it. So it just kind of fits with everything that we have here.
Yeah, it's nice to see reclaimed urban spaces used for food production like this too. And it sounds like this could be a model that can be replicated in other cities.
I think it can be, and I think it you know, I'm not the only person to do this around the country. Mm-hmm. It's starting to be a thing, because I think that the concept of taking the milk from the people who have hardest time producing value into it, but can produce the beautiful milk, take the milk from them, put it in one facility that can produce the value, and then in a place that also has the audience for it and the marketing talent for it and the distribution chain and all that stuff, create the value there, distribute it, you know, go with it. Our meal comes from 40 minutes away. It's not, you know, doesn't really lose value on its way here. So I think this is a really good model for United States of America for 2021.
Yeah, especially for reinforcing those regional food systems, like that the customer, there's a way to do this where you can shorten the distance between the source of the ingredients, the production, and getting it to a customer, which I think over the last couple of years, we've seen was kind of a challenge and continues to be a challenge, actually, with, you know, a lot of the shortages we're seeing with, you know, especially in distribution over long distances.
Right.
And I did want to ask you a little bit about, first of all, starting this whole venture right before the pandemic. What was the timing like for you, and how did it work against you, or maybe even work for you?
Is it one of the, I mean, you know, I have not done it the other way, so I don't know, but it's like, is it six of one, half dozen of the other, maybe. But it's, you know, we received our grant we applied in November 2019 for the grant. We received the grant in January 2020. I was at the Fancy Food Show when I got the notice that we got the grant, and I was like, "Oh my, jeez!" And we made an announcement right there and then, and everybody was like, "Great, you know, the summer show, we're gonna see your stuff." And that was January 2020, and I came back. We were negotiating another property for it, which is actually a historical, like 140-year-old dairy right here in the neighborhood that we were supposed to go into that was being redeveloped. That kind of fell through. I guess they decided that it's better for them to rent it for a gym. And then the pandemic happened. Good luck with the gym. So I was kind of like, I was not sure what I was going to do and if this is still worth it. And I was kind of like, I was a bit in the shell for like, you know, maybe 2 months trying to figure out if I'm, you know, if this even makes sense. And then I got together with an acquaintance who was a local businessman, Leo Voloshin is his name, is a prolific local businessman who's done a lot of urban development, and also him and his wife own a fashion design company that is doing really well. And we kind of got together on this and decided that one of his warehouses would be the absolutely perfect space for this. And it turned out to be the absolute perfect space. So that happened maybe in April, and, you know, but then I was like, okay, let's go build this stuff. And we had, you know, checks, you know, from a grant, and there was no one to build the stuff. So that was a headache. We prefabricated the actual make room in a shipping container in New York. And while we were working on the warehouse here in Philly, and then the idea was to just to finish it and ship it right into the warehouse and just place it inside the warehouse connected to water, electricity, and sewage, and start working, which eventually it's exactly what happened. But just, you know, we could not get a pasteurizer. We had to get one from the Netherlands. We couldn't get a milk tank. We got one from Greece. It was just a weird time. Like, you know, people could not show up, and it was very frustrating, but somehow within 7 months we built the whole thing and put it together. In March, beginning of March, we put the container in the building, and by about 2 weeks later we started producing. So our first day of production was March 29th. So there you go.
And hopefully you know, March 2022, you can have your anniversary party outside in your in your courtyard, and we'll all come and eat cheese and just celebrate this insane journey in, you know, such a short amount of time.
Working on it.
Yeah. There are so many things that we could go deeper on, like build whole episodes around. And this was just such a great opportunity to talk to you, learn more about what you're doing, you know, just to be able to talk about like the development of these new cheeses, to talk about the storytelling. And also even, you know, I would love to have you back one day to talk about how your previous work experience led you or feeds into what you're doing now, because you have had a career in this industry for quite a while.
Right.
But, you know, so if we can make a date for a future part two, that would be great. If you'd like to come back,
yeah,
I would love
it.
Yeah. We'll find a date in 2022. We're going to do this again. But I want to thank you so much for coming on Cutting the Curd. And I wish you all the success in the world with Peristead Dairy. And we look forward to seeing, you know, your future cheeses.
Thank you so much for having me. And, you know, really glad to have this opportunity.
And for all our listeners, make sure to check us out on Instagram. You can learn more about Peristead Dairy. You can look to see what's coming up on future episodes. And thank you so much for joining us.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Thing.